Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to our Bible-based address this evening to the title of An Intelligent Designer is the Origin of Life. So the format for this evening is that we will open with a Bible reading, which will be Psalm 19, and then I'll hand over to our speaker, my friend and brother Stephen Higgs, and he will speak to the title of An Intelligent Designer is the Origin of Life. So reading from Psalm 19 to introduce. So that Bible reading serves to introduce the remarks of my friend and brother, Mr. Stephen Higgs, who will speak to us now on the topic of an intelligent designer is the origin of life.
Thank you very much. And good evening, everybody. Well, our topic tonight is about the origin of life. And particularly, we are maintaining that the origin of life has behind it both design and intelligence. And to begin with, I'd like to just lay the basis of our lecture very clearly. Christadelphians are Bible students. We believe that the Bible is the Word of God. That's why we've read a chapter from it this evening. We believe that it is the word of God to mankind and that it reveals to us God's actions in the past, the present, and his intentions for the future. Christadelphians have always believed in a literal six-day creation as per the accounts in Genesis 1 and 2, and we reject completely the theory of evolution as incompatible with the teaching of the Bible. We believe that the capacity for amazing variation within the created kinds was inbuilt as part of their creation, but that what scientists call macroevolution between species does not and never has occurred. And although our title references intelligent design, and we acknowledge that intelligent design is a significant worldwide movement associated with Christian churches particularly, we are not in any way associated with the intelligent design movement per se. As I said, we've always believed that an intelligent designer is behind the natural creation. And we'll give you some more details on that tonight. In fact, we'll jump straight into that. That's really our first, our kicking off point for the lecture. If you'd like to come to the very first chapter of the Bible, this is made abundantly clear for us. To those who take the time to read its pages, the Bible is remarkably clear and understandable. If you have a look at the very first words of the Bible, it says in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 1, in the beginning God created. And that's what we believe. You see, it was God had a plan and an intention which he progressively carried out, and that's recorded for us through the rest of the first couple of chapters of the Bible. It was God's purpose to create the heaven and the earth. But it wasn't just the universe, the planets, the solar system and the earth itself, the physical earth. It was all those things upon it. I've just picked out a few of the verses. So verse 11 says, and God said, let the earth bring forth grass, the herb yielding seed, the fruit tree yielding fruit after his kind. And I've highlighted that because it tells us from the very beginning that God created a natural law that things produce after their kind. Today, we would say, well, that's because of genetics, that everything has within it the code and the information needed to transfer that particular created kind onto the next generation through the means of its reproduction. So everything reproduced after its kind. And then, of course, it says, and it was so. That would be an understatement, wouldn't it? Because what that actually means is that when God said, let's create all the different kinds of plants upon the earth, it happened. Just to consider the power and the incredible wisdom and design that went into that process is amazing. And we could spend a whole lecture just looking at the amazing design of different plants. We're not actually going to do that tonight because our focus is on the origin of life, an intelligent creator as the origin of life. And so that we focus quite specifically on that tonight. Well, as we go through Genesis chapter 1, verses 20 and 21 tell us, and God said, let the waters bring forth abundantly the moving creature that hath life and fowl that may fly above the earth in the open firmament of heaven. And God created great whales and every creature, living creature that moveth, which the waters brought forth abundantly after their kind, and every winged fowl after his kind, and God saw that it was good. You see, God was exercising quality control upon this process. God saw that it was good. He didn't create half-formed bits and pieces, hoping that later on they may progressively evolve into something more interesting. Everything that God created was just right. And we'll see that as we go. So in verses 24 to 26, notice the emphasis I've highlighted there, after his kind. This is a law of creation. We might call it today the laws of genetics, but everything reproduces after its kind. We don't have one kind turns into another kind. Everything reproduces after its kind. And that verse, those couple of verses there in themselves deny the theory of evolution, which as a fundamental postulate says that one kind turned into another kind. Not so, says the Bible, repeatedly. So we read, let the earth bring forth the living creature after his kind, cattle, creeping thing, and beast of the earth after his kind, and it was so. And God made the beast of the earth after his kind, and cattle after their kind, and everything that creepeth on the earth after his kind, and God saw that it was good. And God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over the cattle and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. So mankind are added to this creation, Adam and Eve, and there are separate details given on the creation of both Adam and Eve, the first man and the first woman. They are created not merely as an adjunct to all the other animals, but with a specific purpose that they might have dominion over the rest of the creation. Man was a unique and different creature from all the other creation because he was created with a plan that was quite different from the rest of the other animals. And once again, this clearly defies the concept of evolution, which suggests that man has descended from some of those other kinds, the beast of the earth after its kind, which is a generic statement for a very large variety of animal kinds. And so in Genesis 2 and verses 4 to 7, in a summary of some of those things that were recorded in chapter 1, we read, these are the generations of the heavens and the earth when they were created in the day that the Lord God made the earth and the heavens, every plant of the field before it was in the earth, and every herb of the field before it grew. And what that is saying, you see, if you read it carefully, he created every plant of the field before it was in the earth. What does that actually mean? It means that it was actually designed and created and then planted. This is a highly intentional process that is not leaving anything to chance. And he says, every plant of the field before it was in the earth, every herb of the field before it grew, for the Lord God had not caused it to rain upon the earth, and there was not a man to till the ground. But there went up a mist from the earth and watered the whole face of the ground. And the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul. And that is an extremely detailed statement about the intentional creation of man. You'll notice that it uses the word that that formed, God formed man of the dust of the ground. That's a design process. And you can imagine God, as we believe that the Bible very clearly teaches, that God created these things through the work of the angels, a multitude of God's messengers who do his will. And so you can imagine quite literally them forming the clay as they created the outline of the man. It's a design process. No, nothing accidental, nothing by chance about this. It's a very deliberate and intentional process. And then, of course, he breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. And in a way, that comes to the very center of our subject for this evening, about the origin of life. You'll notice that it says there, he breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. Before that process, the man was formed but not alive. There is not a scientist upon the face of this earth today who could define what life is. No one ever on the surface of this earth has ever created life from non-life. And believe me, many scientists have spent their entire working life trying to do just that. We'll have a little bit more to say about that later. Life comes from God himself. And later on in the Old Testament, it says that when we die, the energy or life force goes back to God who gave it. And scientists are so keen to look at the origin of life, and perhaps that we start with proteins, small molecules that build to become larger ones and larger and more complex, and eventually a cell. But a protein is just a molecule. It's not alive. It has no life. And even if they were to produce a protein by natural means, it's not alive. And the difference between alive and a non-living thing is an unbreachable gap by mankind. No one even knows what life is, let alone how something inanimate and not alive can be made alive. But the Bible tells us in no uncertain terms that God is the source of life, an intelligent designer. Let's move on. In other parts of the Bible, both Old and New Testament, the Bible reinforces this early account of creation. Some people like to look at the Bible and say, well, you know, Genesis was written a long time ago and it's sort of the Jewish myths, creation myths. But if you actually read the creation myths of various different tribes and nations, First Nations around the world, and then compare it with the account in the Bible, you'll notice a substantive difference between those myths and the Bible account. The myths are clearly fabrications of man's mind, whereas Genesis is clear, it's logical, it's orderly, it's self-consistent, and it's in harmony with scientific fact. So in Exodus chapter 20 and verse 11, we read, "In 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that in them is," all of the creation, made by God himself, "and rested the seventh day. Wherefore the Lord blessed the seventh day, that was a day of rest for the Jews according to God's commandment, and hallowed it." In the very last book of the Bible, it says this, Revelation 10 verse 6, "And swear by him that liveth forever and ever, who created heaven and the things that therein are, and the earth and the things that therein are, and the sea and the things which are therein, that there should be time no longer." So once again, you'll see in the very last book of the Bible, a most clear and emphatic statement that whether we're talking about heaven, earth, or oceans, everything in them was created intentionally by the great God of heaven and earth. Further to that, you'll notice that there was purpose behind the creation.
So Isaiah chapter 45 and verse 18 says, "Thus saith the Lord that created the heavens, God himself that formed the earth and made it, he hath established it, he created it not in vain, he formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord and there is none else." Now, if you ask an evolutionist, what is the purpose of life? You get a very sad and sorry answer, because there is no purpose. Life happened by random chance, and probably they believe that in some future time it will probably be extinguished, and that will be the end of it. It is utterly purposeless. But the Bible explains that God does have a purpose with the earth, an amazing purpose. And that's something that we often have as the subject of our lectures from this platform. He plans to fill this earth with his physical and moral glory and to make it a beautiful place, one that reflects his amazing intellect and creativity forever. Acts chapter 17 and verse 26 again reinforces the account, the Genesis account of creation. I'm reading from the ESV in this case. "And he made from one man, Adam, every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place." You see, the Bible is self-consistent and very clear. No old ancient myths and legends here. Well, let's move on to the design aspect of our topic. We have as our title, "An Intelligent Designer is the Origin of Life." You know, design is something that you can study. You can go to TAFE or university and study design. It's a subject. You can even do it at school. We have it at our school. It's called design, and it's a process. It's a very intentional process. Design involves the expenditure of energy of some kind to create a purposeful arrangement of a set of component parts in order to maximize the function, usefulness, or appearance of the end product. That's design. And it's actually quite easy for us to determine the difference between objects which have formed by random processes and those which have been designed. It's usually relatively easy to pick the difference. And I've put three images at the bottom of the screen there, all of which have been designed. You can tell when you look at them that they've been designed. The first on the left-hand side is a watch, an old-fashioned manual mechanical watch. Incredibly detailed. All the tiny parts that fit exactly together, the precision with which they fit together in order to keep time accurately is remarkable. No one would ever suggest that that had assembled itself over millions of years by chance processes. All of the parts are purposefully arranged. They have their exact position relative to one another. The size is exactly right that they may be able to mesh in together and keep time accurately. And, of course, it creates a useful product. It does something, and it does it well. It keeps time so that we are able to know the time of day, and even many of them the day of the week, the date and so on. The second image is a house. We can see it's been intentionally built. We wouldn't walk through a forest and come across that and think, well, wow, that was a pretty amazing chance that built that. We can tell there are parts that have been intentionally put there. There's a symmetry about it, and there is an order about it, and there is a function. The whole thing comes together to create a function which is very nicely carried out. And so we can glance at it and say, yes, there's design there. The last image is a sea creature called a nudibranch. It's amazing. It's a kind of a mollusk. It doesn't have a shell, which is why it's called a nudibranch. Amazingly coloured and extraordinarily decorated. They can often be found if you're snorkeling around in the ocean. And often they are beautifully coloured, and part of the reason they're coloured is because they're poisonous. And other sea creatures avoid eating them. But again, we can see there the evidence of design. It functions beautifully. They graze around the bottom of the ocean, eating the plants and keeping up they're kind of like the ocean vacuum cleaners, and they keep everything nice and clean. The ubiquitous ballpoint pen, one of the most successful designs of all time. Ballpoint pens, of course, replace fountain pens. Now, I'm old enough to remember fountain pens. Not many will be old enough to remember fountain pens and the nuisance and the mess that often was associated with them. I know a lot of older people actually liked the smooth flow of the ink, but I also remember the blots on the page and the difficulty of getting just the right amount of ink so that it flowed nicely and stopping before you had a dry, scratchy nib on the pen. But ballpoint pens were invented. What an amazing device. But to do that, no one would ever say that that was just accidental. It was very intentional. And the key parts of a ballpoint pen, firstly, is the ball at the end. Did you know they're made of tungsten carbide? They're incredibly hard, and they are just the right size to fit within the tip of the ballpoint pen so that when you move it across the page, they rotate within the end of the pen without falling out or without being too tight. But the ball is only part of the thing that makes them work. The ink behind them has been engineered by chemical engineers to be just the right viscosity so that it sticks onto the ball and comes out of the pen onto the paper, and it's got to dry fast enough so that you don't... I'm left-handed, so I tend to go over the ink when I write, and I usually get ink on the side of my hand. But in most cases, it dries as you're writing, pretty much, unlike the old-fashioned fountain pen, or even before that, the plain nib. But as well as that, of course, you've got to have a store for the ink, so the little tube that goes up inside there. All of those parts were very carefully designed. As I said, the crystal ballpoint pen, which was introduced sometime in the 1960s, I can't remember the date now, but as I said, they've sold billions of those, basically almost unaltered design, because it's extraordinarily functional and successful. Bible believers, as I've already said, believe that we claim that a supremely intelligent creator, God, created every aspect of the created life forms in order to make the creation very good. The very last verse of Genesis chapter 1, actually it's near the end. It says, "And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good." Maybe it was the last verse. So again, notice the quality control. It's almost like, okay, let's have a good look. Oh yes, this is just right. And that's the whole point. The Bible makes it very clear that God did create everything in a very good state. In Job chapter 39 and verse 13, the question is asked by God to Job, "Did you give the goodly wings to the peacock?" And that, again, was a deliberate question that Job was being challenged to think about the incredible power and wisdom of God, who designed things like that. Amazing. Definitely not designed for camouflage. It was designed for beauty. And, of course, it is also used in the mating process, but there's an incredible beauty in that, far more than is necessary as a fundamental, necessary natural function for mating. Now, in contrast to Bible believers, evolution supporters claim that unguided natural forces, and there are only two, mutations and natural selections. Those two processes alone produce what they call the illusion of design. That's a quote from Richard Dawkins. The illusion of design. It looks like it's been designed, but it's just natural forces that have done it. But in fact, they claim, there has been no intelligent design input. Now, if you know anything about science and genetics, you'll know that a mutation is a genetic mistake. A mutation is formed when there is damage to a pre-existing gene. And typically the damage destroys information. In other words, it's a deletion of genetic information, or else it's a scrambling or an insertion of another copy of information, pre-existing information, into the genetic code. And mutations damage the living thing because of the fact that essentially some of the information that is meant to be used to cause this living thing to come into existence is that the information is damaged, and so there is harm that is done to the living thing. Scientists have been madly breeding things like fruit flies and E. coli bacteria now for over 100 years, 150 years, about 170 years now since Darwin wrote Origin of Species. And scientists have been breeding and breeding and breeding hundreds and thousands of generations of these tiny creatures and exposing them to chemicals and radiation, other things that will cause mutations to occur. And yet they have never, ever found anything except damaged creatures. And yet evolutionists would like us to understand and believe that mutation and then natural selection, which favours the damaged gene, will produce what they call the illusion of design. An evolutionary biologist by the name of Francisco Ayala argued that Darwin has accounted for design without a designer and showed that the directive organization of living things can be explained as the result of a natural process, natural selection, without any need to resort to a creator or any other external agent. Believe that if you will. Now, Charles Darwin, who wrote the book Origin of Species, interestingly, was much more interested in origin of general species than origin of life. He did write about the origin of life, but not very much. And there were people who queried him about it and felt that his book was incomplete without a chapter on where life itself came from. And he declined to write that chapter. He didn't want to go there. And he only wrote a few things in written documents about the subject. I'll talk about that a little bit more in a little bit more detail. But Darwin and his contemporaries, they theorised about what they called protoplasm, the beginning cellular material that might have been the origin of life. And they were often called by evolutionary biologists simple cells. But now we know that the so-called simple cells are extraordinarily complex and have amazing functions. And the only way you could really compare a cell to anything that we could sort of understand more clearly would be to describe a cell as like a mega city with its own internal transport and communication systems, storage systems, chemical factories, energy production, energy transfer, all manner of complex organizational structures all existing within a fraction of a millimetre. The last 70 years have seen the discovery of a vast array of incredible detail about the microscopic and submicroscopic structure of cells and of DNA itself, proteins, other molecules which are essential to life. And many scientists began to notice that there were increasing difficulties for evolutionists being able to explain how these things could come to pass, how they could come into being so unutterably complex, how they could come into being step by step by random chance processes. And particularly, some scientists began to notice that many natural systems in living things were made of highly specialized parts that were what they called irreducibly complex. Now, this idea of irreducible complexity is amazingly important. Now, an American molecular biologist named Michael Behe wrote a book in 1996 called Darwin's Black Box. Now, the black box refers to the cell, because Darwin basically said everything probably came from a cell. And so Michael Behe said, it's like a black box. It's all very good to say a cell, but actually let's look inside the cell. Now, he's a molecular biologist, and he wrote this book called The Biochemical Challenge to Evolution. It is a very significant book. And he, in that book, talked in detail about three examples of irreducibly complex systems that he alleged cannot be explained in any way by natural means. The first one was the bacterial flagellum used for locomotion. Now, the flagellum is the little tail-like thing that the bacteria waves around in water so that it can move itself along. The second one was a cascade of molecular reactions that occur in blood clotting or coagulation. And again, a remarkable process, and it's irreducibly complex because you've got to have all of the parts for it to work. If you take away any of the component parts and processes, the whole system fails and the organism dies. The third part was the immune system. We're not even going to deal with numbers 2 and 3 tonight, but we are going to have a little look at number 1. So this is the diagram the animated GIF that I put on the opening slide for tonight. It's a pretty low resolution image, but it was there just to make you wonder. Okay, so this is a diagram of what's called a molecular motor. So the bacteria moves itself around by whipping this whip-like tail backwards and forwards. But Michael Behe studied this and discovered that there is incredible design in this. And even evolutionary biologists commenting on these molecular motors said that it looks in every way like a human-designed motor. It's got all the parts and functionality of a very, very efficient motor. Now, as I put on the screen there, the flagellum can spin up to 100,000 revs per minute. That's pretty fast. And it can move the cell up to 10 body lengths per second. Now, I'd like to know if anyone here can swim 10 body lengths per second. I know Liz is a pretty good swimmer, but not that good. 10 body lengths per second, that's about 20 metres a second for a human. And it's going through water because they're bacteria, they're living in fluid. So pretty amazing. So let's have a bit more of a look at this. Okay, that's a more detailed diagram. Now it looks like someone's gone kind of crazy crocheting, doesn't it? It's not. That's actually the result of electron microscopy, where they have done very detailed examination of the structure of the core, the rotor of the motor. Now, each one of those coloured sections is actually a series of proteins, and the colours are just used to identify the different proteins. There's about 15 proteins that make this motor. And they're controlled by about a total of 35 genes. And these proteins fit together, that's the rotor of the motor, And this little green thing over here, it has a very interesting function. Now, I don't know if I can play this because it's actually live to the net and I don't think I have a good connection. Oh, yes, okay. So you can see the green thing is what actually turns and spins the rotor. And we haven't got the shaft through there or any of the other details. So this is a picture of bacteria with the whip-like flagellum. What's more, this motor can change direction. So it can go forward, but then with a slight molecular adjustment, it can reverse. Okay, that's it for that one. Now, just try and move on. Yeah, okay, great. All right, so that's a sort of a diagram. Just to give you a bit more information, basically the motor fits between the outside of the cell, which is up here, and the inside cell wall of the motor, which is down here, of the cell. So this is like the wall of the cell. So this is the interior part of the cell. This is the shaft, and this part here is what we were looking at a few minutes ago, this part. These are the parts, the stators that make it rotate. Fascinatingly enough, the cell has the bacteria have the ability to bring in more stators when they need more torque of the motor. So they can actually vary the speed and torque of the motor by going from one up to a dozen of these little stators, the spinning things, to spin the motor faster and with more torque. And they all work and coordinate together to go forwards and backwards. Unbelievable. What's more, at the junction there, where it's got the hook, because, of course, the motor is spinning this way, and it has to be turned into propulsion for the bacteria. So up in here, there is a universal joint that allows doing its rotary motion, that is turned into a flapping sort of motion of the flagella, the filament there. Quite incredible. Now, you can probably see why it is that and there's some more detail. So that's the ring that holds it steady. And this is the base of that hook at the top. And that's the base and the little stator there on the motor. So you can probably see why when this molecular biologist was looking at this, thinking, whoa, this is a single-celled creature. This is one of the things that Darwin was looking at and saying, probably this simple thing here must have been nearly the very first beginning living thing. Well, really? It's incredibly complex. So much so that molecular biologists still are trying to find out how this thing works. It's called a proton pump because it actually uses a potential difference generated by a difference in concentration of hydrogen ions between the top and the bottom of the central shaft. And that's part of the reason as to why it works. But it's beautifully designed and it can go for years. Well, I don't know how long an individual bacterium works. It's probably not that long, but as I said, beautifully designed. Now, this leads us on to the challenge of in irreducible complexity. You see, it's a problem for evolutionists because they rely upon step by step by step gradual change. But you can't do that because imagine a little single-celled bacteria that's just a blob just sitting there. Maybe it's wiggling a bit, but it wants to get over there because there's food over there, but it can't because it doesn't have a little whippy thing. And so it has to try and figure out how it's going to do this little whippy thing. But of course, to make a motor like that, it has to have all of those 15 different proteins every one of which is an incredible molecule of up to 1,000 amino acid residues or even more in a line in an exact sequence. And if one is not in sequence, the whole molecule has a different shape and won't fit together. So it's just unbelievably ridiculous to imagine it happening by chance. And I just summarized at the bottom of the screen there, systems like these show the fingerprint of a vastly intelligent designer. They do indeed. So we believe that it's an all or nothing scenario and evolution simply fails to explain. Now, I want to briefly touch on three other issues that are a problem for evolutionists. Firstly, maths. Now, everyone loves maths, so I'm not going to dive deep into this. In fact, it's a very light touch, really. But we know that evolutionists believe that proteins and other molecules evolve by chance processes. Now, it's not difficult to calculate the mathematical probability of a protein forming. And one scientist, in fact, I'll just mention at the bottom of the slide there, it's a book I have at home. It's called Evolution Possible, Impossible. It's written by a mathematician who was studying the probability of such things, these evolutionary events occurring. Now, he said, even a tiny protein, which has only got 100 amino acid residues, for it to be assembled by chance processes under the best possible conditions, and there are a whole lot of riders underneath this, because the reality is that in nature, you don't have the best possible conditions. But imagining the very best possible conditions to assemble a protein by chance, the probability of turning out a protein that actually was useful, one particular protein out of 100 random amino acids, there are 20 naturally occurring ones that are used, the probability would be less than 1 in 20 to the power 100. Now, to give you an idea, the number of atoms in the universe is estimated by evolutionary scientists to be about 10 to the power 80. And that's atoms in the universe. And they're saying that this man is saying the probability of a single amino acid forming is less than 1 in 20 to the power 100, which is huge. It's basically the numbers very quickly become so large as to be utterly impossible. And there are a number of analogies that have been given, you know, like if an amoeba was crawling at 1 centimetre per year, in the time it took for this protein to occur, it could cross the universe about a million times. It's just utterly absurd. Okay, here's another problem. Information. On the left is a little piece of computer code. It's information, all right? If you open a book, you've possibly got a book open on your lap right now. There's information in the book. There's an intelligent mind that is behind that. Same with the computer code there. Some intelligent person actually worked out that code and put it all down. Well, DNA is information. It's a code for the information needed to build a living thing. It's a very specific order. Now, this is just a picture of the double helix structure of the DNA with the base pairs joining together. And up the top is just the letters for some of the DNA sequences, the base pair sequences. So so DNA is full of information, and our DNA, we have about 3.1 billion base pairs in our DNA, in our cells. And that DNA, the information, the coded information in the base pairs, represents information. It's been calculated, as I've got on the screen there, the information, the DNA in each one of us, if one base pair was represented by one letter, would be enough to fill 1,000 1,000-page telephone books. Now, most of the young people don't even know what a telephone book is because we don't have them anymore, but they used to be quite large books, pretty large, A4 size or roughly, and about that thick. Okay, so that's a lot of information. 1,000 of those. That's just a summary of the information. Where did that information come from? You know, this is one of the things that spawned the intelligent design movement. A scientist also from America called Stephen Meyer has written books about this particular subject, in the information problem, because he said wherever you look around in the world, where there is a set of information, in every case, without exception, it's come from an intelligent mind. Every living thing is based on coded information in its DNA. And evolutionary scientists know that, but they cannot explain where that informational content came from. And sadly, mutations are like someone going to a book and chopping little bits out and stabbing it, and so that when you come to the book, you can't read it properly. It's got bits missing. And maybe a page has been torn out and inserted somewhere else. That's what mutations do. They damage the information. But it's impossible for a mutation to generate meaningful new information to add to the genetic code. There is no mechanism for that to happen. An entropy problem. Now, this is a bit of physics. In order to create more and more complex creatures via random evolutionary processes, you need a higher degree of order and complexity. And that goes against the second law of thermodynamics, often called the law of entropy, which states that the total entropy or degree of disorder or randomness of a system either increases or remains constant in any spontaneous process. It never decreases. In simple terms, things tend to get messy. All right, now I could say to any parent here, what happens to your kids' bedrooms? You go in there, it's all nice and tidy. What happens at the end of a day? In many cases, it's not quite so tidy. All right, because that's what happens. Or if I ask, these days cars are built to a better standard, but if you buy a new car, and have a look at that car 20 years later, even with decent care and maintenance, it's not the car it was, because things tend to break down. Iron tends to rust. Plastic tends to fatigue and snap. Rubber tends to go hard and split. Paint tends to crack and fade. That's the law of entropy. Everything seems to break down. Sadly, even us. And this is another problem for evolutionists. Where did death come from? Because life always ends in death. And another subject that we aren't able to deal with tonight, but of course the Bible offers a hope of escape from everlasting death. God offers everlasting life, and that's something that no evolutionist can ever ask, ever offer. So all things tend to decay and break down. Unless external energy is used to reverse that breaking down process. That's a massive problem for the evolution of life because, you know, Darwin imagined that, I'll move straight onto it. So Darwin imagined that maybe, you know, some chance process might have caused life. In Darwin's time, the theory of spontaneous generation was still very popular amongst scientists, despite the fact that Louis Pasteur had proved experimentally that living things do not rise from non-living. And there's a classic quote here from a person who, if he was alive today, would be very embarrassed. He wrote, "When water from the purest spring is placed in a flask steeped in leavening fumes, gas released by yeast, ethanol, and carbon dioxide, it putrefies, engendering maggots. The fumes which rise from the bottom of a swamp produce frogs, ants, leeches, and vegetation." That's what many scientists believe, even in Darwin's time. some of his close associates believed in spontaneous generation. Now, that's a little diagram of Louis Pasteur's experiment. It can be very easily performed. So he boiled this broth and he used a swan neck on the flask that had a liquid in it so that that air couldn't seep back into it. And he found that no microbes were produced. But if you did the same process but opened the flask and left it open, then it would very quickly go off. And he demonstrated that it was actually things from outside coming into the broth that were generating life. We know that. But ironically, evolutionists today still want to tell us that life comes from non-life. They just can't explain how. So Darwin said in Origin of Species, all organic beings which have ever lived on this earth may be descended from some primordial form. He was very keenly aware that there was no explanation as to how that happened. He wasn't a supporter of spontaneous generation. Now, we've nearly run out of time, so I'm going to hop through a whole lot of things. Okay, this one here is worth a quick comment. A lot of you may have heard about scientists putting gases in a flask and zapping it with sparks, high voltage, in order to try and simulate their idea of a pond full of chemicals that were being hit by lightning repeatedly and maybe producing some amino acids. Well, this experiment, in 1953, an experiment was done by scientists Miller and Urey. They mixed methane, ammonia, hydrogen, and water. In the absence of oxygen, they used heat and high voltage to zap the mixture. And they reported traces of a couple of amino acids, some glycine and some alanine, in the mixture. And this was widely hailed as evolutionists discovering the origin of life. Actually, it wasn't at all. They had less than 1% of those molecules had turned into those amino acids. And those amino acids, it's a complicated story, but they in nature, they have a right and a left hand like we do. They're mirror images. They're not identical. And they form in equal amounts in this experiment. But in nature, when you have equal amounts, they actually break each other down. And in living cells, they only form left-handed. And no scientist has been able to simulate that process. So since the Miller-Urey experiment, a lot of scientists spent a lot of time wanting to jump on this bandwagon and find out more. Can we make life? But to this day, they have not been able to succeed. In fact, they've found insurmountable problems in every aspect of this. Well, let's go to Romans chapter 1 in the New Testament, because in Romans chapter 1, God tells us something pretty blunt. And we need to hear these words. There is a vast difference between the teaching of evolution and the Bible's teaching of creation. One offers hope and is based on evidence. The other offers nothing. Let's read Romans chapter 1, and I've got verses 18 to 20 on the screen. I think this is from the ESV, if I remember rightly. It may not be. No, I think it's from the AV. He says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth." And that is indeed what supporters of evolution have done with the Bible. They've tried to ridicule and squash the teaching of the Bible. "For what can be known about God..." Yeah, it is from a different translation. I think it was the ESV. "Is plain to them because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived even ever since the creation of the world in the things which have been made. So they are without excuse." So what this is saying to us very clearly is simply this. Look at the natural creation. It tells you that there is a God. That's what he's saying there. But it doesn't stop there. He says, for although they knew God, they did not honour him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Therefore, God gave them up to the lusts in their hearts, to impurity, to the dishonouring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator who is blessed forever. Amen. Now, those words are extremely powerful, and they are as powerful today as the day they were written. The theory of evolution exchanges the truth of God for a lie, and yet is promoted by fact, as a fact. And sadly, those who follow the theory of evolution, as these verses say, because there is no morality in evolution, it's a survival of the fittest, they tend to move, there is no reason for them to adhere to the moral principles that the Bible outlines, and therefore they do follow simply the desires of their own bodies, and they reap to themselves the consequences of those choices. Now, you know, it's interesting that for a long time, the Bible and creation were described as two books, the two books of God, two books of revelation that should be read together for understanding the fullness of God's revelation. It's like creation is one of the books of God. You can look at that book and you can see the wisdom and power and creative mind and genius of God. And then you come to the Bible and you can understand his teaching and his moral principles and his purpose with the earth. Science, we believe, is a God-given tool for discerning the handiwork of God in creation. We don't have anything to fear from science. True science, Bible believers love it because it's simply opening up the divine hand, the divine handiwork, and is fully compatible with the Word of God. Now, I'm going to skip over those because that doesn't really matter anymore. Let's come to our reading, Psalm 19. We'll finish off with that. Now, you may have noticed in Psalm 19 when we were reading, there's a sudden change of thought in the middle of the psalm. The first six verses are talking about the natural creation. The heavens, verse 1, declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Notice the element of design there, the handiwork of God. Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night shows knowledge. There is no speech or word, and it says a language where their voice is not heard. In the margin of my Bible, in the centre margin, it says, without these, their voice is heard. You don't need speech. Just look at the things God has created and you see evidence of his power and existence. And so the first six verses are talking about the incredible handiwork of God. And then verse 7, he suddenly changes. And verses 7 to 11, look what he says. The law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The statutes of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. You see, what he's telling us is this is the other book of God. Both of these books are incredibly important. The natural creation declares the glory of God. So does the Bible. But it declares a lot more than that. We need them together, friends, and between the two, we can understand so much more about God. We've got to finish. So I would like to simply refer to Acts chapter 17. I've got it on the screen here. The Apostle Paul was preaching to people in Athens. And it says there, when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, of Jesus Christ, some mocked, but others said, we'll hear you again about this. But some men joined and believed, among whom were also were Dionysius the Areopagite and a woman named Damaris and others with them. You know, this verse has categorised three responses to the message. One, people mock. Two, they procrastinated. Yeah, we'll listen to that some other time. But ultimately, they did nothing. But the third class joined the apostles. They believed and they acted on that belief. So we leave you with the challenge. What are you going to do with the life that an intelligent creator has given you?